Well, isn't that a happy song? But I'm so sorry to say we don't have any Iris birthdays today. On Veterans Day, Armistice Day, no birthdays? Wow. Well, if today is your birthday and you did not hear your name, which you didn't, please give us a call to make sure that we get you on our birthday list. Our phone number, 515-243-6833, or the toll-free number from anywhere in Iowa, 1-877-404-4747. Well, we're so glad to have you with us. If you're listening on your television, internet, or mobile device, and you are not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call. We need to know who's listening and how you are listening in order to keep our services free. You can catch a replay of today's reading at 6 p.m. and 1 a.m. here on IRIS. Today's show, as well as many of our other newspapers and programs, are available as podcasts on our website, iowareading.org. So that does it for today's birthdays and announcements. We didn't have either. And so here's Barb DeHeck to carry on with reading the newspaper.
Okay, this is a story from Nation and World News. Consumer prices soar by 6.2% over the past year. American households have been struggling with accelerating inflation for months. On Wednesday, the government spelled out just how much they have. Prices for U.S. consumers jumped 6.2% in October compared with a year earlier, as surging costs for food, gas, and housing left families facing the highest inflation rate since 1990. The year-over-year rise in the Consumer Price Index exceeded the 5.4% rise in September, the Labor Department said. From September to October, prices jumped by 0.9%. Inflation is eroding the strong gains in wages and salaries that have flowed to American workers in recent months, creating political headaches for the Biden administration and congressional Democrats, and intensifying pressure on the Federal Reserve as it considers how fast to withdraw its efforts to boost the economy. With Americans in the midst of planning year-end travel, Thanksgiving meals, and holiday gifts, the jump in inflation is making the cost of those purchases significantly higher than they were last year. Fueling the spike in prices has been robust consumer demand, which has run into persistent supply shortages from COVID-related factory shutdowns in China, Vietnam, and other overseas manufacturers. Ports are bottlenecked, with a lack of shipping containers magnifying the problem. America's employers, facing worker shortages, have also been handing out sizable pay raises, and many of them have raised prices to offset their higher labor costs. The result has been accelerating prices for a broad range of consumer goods, from food, heating oil, and patio furniture, to paints, chemicals, and window blinds. After initially affecting mainly goods in pandemic-disrupted industries, surging inflation has broadened into many services many services on which Americans spend money, notably for restaurant meals, rental apartments, and medical services, which jumped 0.5% in October. U.S. car prices jumped again last month after having eased in August and September. The cost of a used vehicle rose 2.5% from September to October and has soared more than 25% from a year ago. With automakers having sharply slowed production because of parts shortages, prices for new cars have risen for 7 straight months. Grocery prices have climbed 5.4% in the past year, which will make Thanksgiving meals much costlier. The price of beef roast has leaped 25% from a year ago. Bacon is up 20%. In the past year, energy costs have jumped a whopping 30%, with gasoline soaring nearly 50%. A gallon of gas on average was $3.42 nationwide on Tuesday, according to the AAA. That's up from just $2.11 a year ago. Natural gas prices are also surging, and so is heating oil. The Energy Information Administration forecasts that these increases will bite hard this winter, with Americans expected to spend 30% more on natural gas and 43% more on heating oil. Fast food prices soared 7.1% in October from a year earlier, the government said Wednesday. That was the largest such increase on record, reflecting higher costs for beef and other foods, as well as rapidly rising labor costs.
And the EU accuses Belarus of luring migrants. This from Warsaw, Poland. European Union officials on Wednesday accused Belarus of state-sponsored trafficking of human lives by luring desperate migrants to the Polish border, the edge of the EU, where many are now stuck in makeshift camps in freezing weather. As the crisis showed no sign of easing, an EU leader also said the bloc was, for the first time, considering the idea of funding the construction of a wall or some other barrier on its eastern border. That idea has always been rejected before and still faces many political and humanitarian obstacles. Polish authorities estimate that about 3,000 to 4,000 migrants have gathered along its border with Belarus, with hundreds concentrated in one makeshift camp not far from the Kuznica crossing. Warsaw has bolstered security at the frontier, where it has declared a state of emergency. Polish authorities have tweeted video of migrants, some using shovels and wire cutters, trying to break through a fence on the border to enter Poland. The West has accused Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko of encouraging migrants from the Middle East to travel to his country and sending them toward EU members Poland, Lithuania, and Latvia as a way to retaliate against the bloc for sanctions imposed on the authoritarian regime for its crackdown on internal dissent since a disputed election in 2020. Belarus denies the allegations, but has said it will no longer stop migrants and others seeking to enter the EU. From a distance, these events on the Polish-Belarusian border may look like a migration crisis, but this is not a migration crisis. It is a political crisis triggered with the special purpose of destabilizing the situation in the European Union, said Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki. Stefan Seibert, a spokesman for German Chancellor Angela Merkel, said in Berlin that Minsk is engaged in state-run smuggling and trafficking, happening 100% at the expense of the people who are lured into the country with false promises. Poland says Russia bears some responsibility for the crisis, given its staunch backing of Lukashenko. Germany's interior minister, Horst Seehofer, also accused Lukashenko of using people's fates with the support of Russian President Vladimir Putin to destabilize the West. Merkel spoke by phone with Putin on Wednesday. I asked him to exert his influence on President Lukashenko because people are being used here, she said. Speaking ahead of a meeting with Latvian and Portuguese leaders, Merkel thanked Poland, Lithuania, and Latvia for protecting the EU's external borders. Latvian Prime Minister Krijanas Karas added that it is what I would call a state-sponsored human trafficking, which is affecting directly my country, Lithuania, and Poland. The Kremlin's account of the call with Merkel said Putin proposed a discussion between representatives of EU member states and Minsk. It also said Putin and Merkel agreed to continue the conversation.
Trump denied blockage of records. A federal judge rejected former President Donald Trump's request to block the release, the release of documents to the House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot. In denying a preliminary injunction, U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan said Tuesday that Congress had a strong public interest in obtaining records that could shed light on a violent insurrection mounted by the former president's supporters. She added that President Joe Biden had the authority to waive executive privilege over the documents, despite Trump's assertions otherwise. Barring a court order, the National Archives plans to turn over Trump's records to the committee by Friday. But Trump's lawyers swiftly promised an appeal. The case will likely eventually head to the U.S. Supreme Court. At bottom, this is a dispute between a former and incumbent president, Chutkan wrote. And the Supreme Court has already made clear that in such circumstances, the incumbent's view is accorded greater weight. Trump does not acknowledge the deference owed to Biden's judgment as the current president, Chutkan said. She noted examples of past presidents declining to assert executive privilege and rejected what she said was Trump's claim that executive privilege exists in perpetuity. Presidents are not king, and president in the plaintiff is not president, she said. And the World Health Organization reports COVID down, except in Europe. The World Health Organization reported Wednesday that coronavirus deaths rose by 10% in Europe in the past week, making it the only world region in which both COVID-19 cases and deaths are steadily increasing. It was the sixth consecutive week that the virus has risen across the continent. In its weekly report, the UN Health Agency said there were about 3.1 million new cases globally, about a 1% increase from the previous week. Nearly two-thirds of the coronavirus infections, 1.9 million, were in Europe, where cases rose by 7%. The countries with the highest numbers of new cases worldwide were the United States, Russia, Britain, Turkey, and Germany. The number of weekly COVID-19 deaths fell by about 4% worldwide and declined in every region except Europe. Out of the 61 countries WHO includes in the European region, which includes Russia and Central Asia, 42% reported a jump in cases of at least 10%. In the Americas, WHO said new weekly cases fell by 5% and deaths declined by 14%, with the highest number reported in the U.S.
Well, the Nation and World Watch Wire reports, the first one from Houston. Houston mayor says three still in critical condition from Astroworld. Three concert goers remain in critical condition after a massive crowd surge during a Travis Scott performance that left eight people dead and hundreds more injured at the Astroworld Music Festival. Houston's mayor said Wednesday, Mayor Sylvester Turner did not provide details about the conditions of the fans who have been hospitalized since the rapper's headliner performance Friday night. But the family of a 9-year-old boy who attended the concert with his father has said the child is in a medically induced coma. From Albany, New York, the Attorney General releases interview transcripts in Cuomo harassment probe. New York's Attorney General released hundreds of pages of transcripts Wednesday of interviews conducted during an investigation into the sexual harassment allegations that forced Governor Andrew Cuomo from office last summer. The transcripts covered interviews done with 10 of the women who accused Cuomo of misconduct, plus the interview that Cuomo gave on July 17th to independent investigators hired by Attorney General Letitia James. During his lengthy interrogation, Cuomo denied many of the allegations. From Tokyo, Kishido wins re-election as Japan's prime minister, takes on economy. Fumio Kishida was re-elected as Japan's prime minister Wednesday after his governing party scored a major victory in key parliamentarian elections. Elected just over a month ago by parliament, Kishida called a quick election in which his governing party secured 261 seats in the 465-member lower house, the more powerful of Japan's two-chamber legislature. Enough to maintain a free hand in pushing legislation through parliament, the win is seen as a mandate from voters for his government to tackle the economy. The last one comes from Islamabad. Taliban urge ex-Afghan military pilots to remain, serve the nation. A top Taliban official urged former Afghan military pilots to remain in the country, saying they were protected by a national amnesty and would not face arrest. Assurances came after dozens of U.S.-trained Afghan pilots left Tajikistan in a U.S.-brokered evacuation Tuesday, 3 months after they sought refuge there from a Taliban takeover. Afghan Air Force pilots played a key role alongside their U.S. counterparts in the 20-year war against Taliban insurgents that ended with the departure of foreign troops in August.
And this from USA Today. Denied by Trump, soldiers may now get Purple Heart. The Army is considering more than doubling the number of Purple Heart medals given to soldiers wounded in the Iranian ballistic missile attack on their base in Iraq in January 2020, an attack the Trump administration downplayed as concerns swirled about an escalating conflict. It wasn't until more than a month after the attack that the Pentagon acknowledged that more than 100 troops had suffered traumatic brain injuries from the 13 missiles that slammed into the base. About 80 troops involved in the attack submitted paperwork for the Purple Heart, the medal given to troops killed or wounded by enemy action. The military awarded 30. Most of the 80 troops were under the command of Colonel Gregory Fix at the time, and he submitted Purple Heart paperwork for them in January 2020. Before submission, I conducted an extensive rule of each Purple Heart award package to ensure compliance, Fix wrote last month in a memo obtained by USA Today. He said he was instructed not to inquire about or resubmit the paperwork for 33 soldiers. The Army now anticipates receiving 30 more submissions for Purple Hearts and will process them, Lieutenant Colonel Gabe Ramirez, an Army spokeswoman, said Tuesday. Beyond its symbolism, the Purple Heart carries entitlements that include priority health care upon retirement from the Veterans Affairs Department, preference for hiring for federal jobs. Excuse me, I do apologize. And eligibility for burial at Arlington National Cemetery. A soldier who suffered a brain injury and an official who surveyed the damage from the missiles said commanders discourage wounded troops from filing paperwork for the Purple Heart. After the attack, President Donald Trump was dismissive when asked about troop injuries during a news conference. "I don't consider them very serious injuries relative to other injuries that I've seen," Trump said. Traumatic brain injuries are not as obvious as a lost limb from a bomb explosion. Brain injuries may qualify troops for a Purple Heart when the injuries are documented by a medical officer. The Pentagon struggles to count the wounds accurately, according to an Inspector General's report, which found estimates vary as to how many troops suffered brain injuries in the attack in 2020. A statement from the U.S. Central Command in 2020 noted that traumatic brain injuries did not automatically qualify troops for the award, and the process for determining eligibility was designed to be a fair and impartial proceeding that evaluated each case in accordance with applicable regulations. The missile attack from Iran followed a U.S. drone strike on January 22, 2020, near Baghdad's airport that killed General Qasem Soleimani, leader of Iran's elite Quds Force. U.S. officials characterized his killing as defensive, saying Soleimani planned attacks on American diplomats and troops. Iran responded 6 days later by firing ballistic missiles at Ayn al-Assad base in Iraq, where hundreds of U.S. troops were stationed. Intelligence reports gave U.S. troops hours of advance notice that the attack was coming, according to a soldier who was not authorized to speak publicly about the attack or the wounds he suffered. A soldier was writing a farewell letter to his daughter when the alarm sounded. The missiles would strike within minutes. The first volley of 3 rounds rocked his building, enveloping everybody in dust, he said. The explosions broke windows more than a mile away, according to a defense official who was not authorized to speak publicly. The days after the attack were fraught and busy, the soldier at Ain al-Assad recalled. Worry persisted that Iran could attack again, that the U.S. could launch a retaliatory strike, or that Iraq would rescind its welcome, requiring U.S. troops to evacuate immediately. The soldier returned to duty despite headaches. He was told later that not being treated immediately meant that he and several others wouldn't qualify for the award. The soldier and some of his colleagues experienced headaches, anger issues, and slurred speech, he said. Doctors and commanders were reluctant to categorize them as wartime casualties, he said, and discouraged him from filing the necessary paperwork. A board convened by the task force overseeing operations in Iraq determined who qualified for the Purple Heart from the attack. Further muddying the issue is confusion within the Pentagon about how many troops suffered brain injuries. Central Command reported that 110 troops had brain injuries. A separate office counted 87, according to the Defense Department's Inspector General. The soldier, in his 30s, continues to take medication. He said receiving the Purple Heart would signify formal recognition that he was wounded in combat and help make things right.
Accused Kenosha shooter testifies. The Kyle Rittenhouse murder trial took on an emotional and heated turn Wednesday when Rittenhouse cried on the stand. The judge berated prosecuting attorney Thomas Binger, and the defense asked for a mistrial. Rittenhouse testified Wednesday that a man he is accused of murdering threatened to kill him on a night of violent protests in Kenosha last year after the police shooting of Jacob Blade. Rittenhouse, 18, broke down as he described the events of August 25, 2020, that led to him fatally shooting Joseph Rosenbaum, 36. Rittenhouse is also accused of murdering Anthony Huber, 26, and wounding Gage Crosskreutz, 27. I didn't do anything wrong. I defended myself, Rittenhouse said. After Rittenhouse began to cry, the judge called for a morning break. Rittenhouse returned to finish questions from his defense attorneys. Before the court broke for lunch, Judge Bruce Schroeder reprimanded Prosecutor Binger over his lines of questioning. Rittenhouse's defense team asked for a mistrial, but Schroeder did not immediately rule on the motion. Rittenhouse and his attorneys said his acts were self-defense, as he feared for his life that evening. He faces counts of intentional homicide, reckless and attempted homicide, and could get life in prison if convicted. Rittenhouse said, Rosenbaum screamed, "If I catch any of you expletives alone, I'm going to expletive kill you," and said, "I'm going to cut your expletive hearts out." I was in shock, Rittenhouse said. After the shooting, Rittenhouse said, he headed toward a police line to turn himself in. He said a, quote, mob chased him. Huber struck him with a skateboard and a rock hit his head. Rittenhouse testified that he then felt lightheaded and collapsed. He fired 2 shots at a man but missed, he said. Huber struck Rittenhouse again with the skateboard, Rittenhouse said, and he fatally shot Huber. Rittenhouse said he saw Grosskreutz approach and point a pistol at him. Rittenhouse fired 1 shot at him, he said. During cross-examination, Rittenhouse said he used deadly force to stop the people attacking him. Rittenhouse said he tried to turn himself in once he reached the police line, but an officer told him to leave the area. Rittenhouse testified a friend drove him home to Antioch, Illinois, and his mother drove him to a police station. The testimony came a day after the state rested and the defense began its case. During cross-examination, Binger pressed on the timing of Rittenhouse's testimony. after Rittenhouse had heard days of testimony and watched video of the shootings. Schroeder admonished Binger for what he said were comments about Rittenhouse's right to remain silent and not incriminate himself. "You're right on the borderline, and you may be over, but it better stop," Schroeder said. Binger questioned Rittenhouse about an incident recorded on video about 10 days before the fatal shootings. Rittenhouse and his friend were in a car watching people leave a CVS store across the street. Rittenhouse apparently believed the people leaving the store had robbed it or were shoplifting. Rittenhouse said, "I wish I had my AR. I'd fire some rounds at them." Months ago, Binger sought to introduce the video as evidence of, quote, other acts that he said showed Rittenhouse's state of mind, his willingness or desire to use deadly force to protect property without full information. Schroeder said he was strongly leaning toward not allowing it. Defense attorney Mark Richards objected immediately when Binger mentioned the CVS on Wednesday and the jury was sent out. Richard asked that Binger be strongly admonished. Binger apologized for not seeking permission from the judge before bringing up the CVS incident, but said Schroeder's earlier ruling left the door open to raising it at trial. "Don't get brazen with me," Schroeder yelled as he told Binger not to continue the line of questioning. After the lunch break, the defense asked for a mistrial with prejudice, meaning Rittenhouse could not be retried. Attorneys argued Binger knew introducing the evidence would be detrimental to Rittenhouse and suggested he may have intentionally sought a mistrial so the case could be tried again. Schroeder said he would give the state time to respond and again admonished Binger. Binger said he brought the incident up in good faith. "I don't believe you," Schroeder replied. Binger spent more than an hour pressing Rittenhouse on why he had his gun with him and the amount of risk he perceived in the crowd. Rittenhouse said, "I didn't want to have to kill anybody that night." Well, so that brings us to the halfway point of today's Des Moines Register here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All programs heard on IRIS are intended for the use of Iowans who have a print disability. If you are not a registered IRIS listener or would like more information about our service, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 or toll free at 1-877-404-4747. We need to know who is listening to keep our services free. For the past 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb DeHeck and Linda Lundgren. We're glad to have you listening. Now, we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
back from our short break. I'm Dorothy Hockenberg, and my partner at the other microphone for the next 90 minutes is Randy Vogel. We will be reading the opinions, obituaries, sports, and other news from today's Des Moines Register and USA Today. We will wrap up with Dear Abby and a weather recap, but we will start with the opinion from the Des Moines Register. This is your turn. And the headline is Veterans Day, A Debt Continues to Mount. It is by Joe Klein, who is a patient rights advocate, and attorney Joe Klein is the author of Patient or Pawn, Epic Fails in Healthcare, The Approaching Perfect Storm, and Strategies for Self-Preservation. He says, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. That's the moment in history regarded as the end of World War I, which inspired the first November 11 Veterans Day. Since 1954, it's been designated as a time to honor veterans of all wars. A World War II vet, my father, was the youngest among his siblings. So I had uncles who fought in the war to end all wars from 1917 to 1918. A few of my peers still have parents among the 1.2 million survivors of World War II and the Korean War. But nearly three-fourths of veterans now living are from the Vietnam and Gulf War eras. Taking one day to honor the sacrifices made by veterans, both great and ultimate, is little to ask. I believe Veterans Day might also be a good time for us to consider whether we are doing all we should to address the unique health care issues burdening our servicemen and women. By the way of backstory, the end of World War II on September 2, 1945, meant the beginning of a historic baby boom. Sure enough, we're having an elder boom 70 years later, and the number of persons aged 65 and older in the United States will increase 17 million by 2030. At the same time, nearly half of all adults now have two or more chronic conditions. Projections are for an additional 2.6 million healthcare workers by the end of this decade to meet those collective healthcare demands. And that doesn't replace those who retire or quit. How will similar demographics affect veterans' health care? It's difficult to say for sure because there has not been a full and detailed accounting of the United States veteran population since the nationwide census of 2000. There are an estimated 6 million living Vietnam veterans, but as stated in the 2018 Institute of Medicine report on Agent Orange exposure, data on related deaths has been elusive. A bit of an understatement. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention stopped tracking Vietnamese veterans' post-service deaths in 1987, and the most recent comprehensive study was done in 2000. We do, however, know that today's veterans have a median age of 65, and enrollment in the Veterans Health Administration has increased 70% over the past 20 years, but still represents only half of the veteran population. Veterans of all eras have health care demands unique in nature and intensity. More than one-fourth of veterans have service-connected disabilities, but there is still much to learn about the age-related progression of those conditions. Is the Veterans Health Administration doing a better job than its civilian counterparts at preparing for this predictable crisis of access? I sure hope so. The suicide rate for veterans is 50% higher than for adult non-veterans. And although HHS admits 40 million to 45 million Americans with mental health needs are being underserved, it assures us there will be a staggering surplus of mental health professionals by the end of the decade. Healthcare professionals serving both veterans and non-veterans are retiring in record numbers, just like the rest of the boomers, and leaving clinical work due to burnout. That's why there's a projected shortage of up to 121,000 physicians by 2030. While lawmakers pat themselves on the back for funding an additional 1,000 medical residencies over a 5-year period. None of that posturing makes sense or bodes well for veteran and non-veteran healthcare consumers. This year on Veterans Day, let's make a point to thank veterans for their service and sacrifice in protecting our rights, and perhaps also use the occasion to ask policymakers how they plan to preserve veterans' rights to autonomous and safe health care. Again, that was by Joe Klein.
Okay, we have a Your Turn article written by Paul Brandis. Paul is the founder and White House bureau chief of West Wing Reports and a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors. His latest book is Jackie, Her Transformation from First Lady to Jackie O. The title of the article is Biden Approval Ratings Are Low, But His Success Is High. Let me see if I've got this right. 5.8 million jobs added to the economy this year, including 531,000 last month. Unemployment's down to 4.6%. COVID-19 vaccinations of America's children are underway. About 28 million kids ages 5 to 11 are eligible to be protected. Meanwhile, the 90-day average of both cases and deaths among the overall U.S. population is trending steadily lower as vaccinations increase. A $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill has been approved by Congress. Money, gobs of it, will soon start flowing to all 50 states for badly needed road and bridge repairs. Rural communities with poor internet service could soon have high-speed broadband. Lead pipes, which deliver tainted water to countless communities, will be replaced. The nation's rickety power grid will get an upgrade. What else? Wages are up 4.2% over the past year, slightly higher than the core inflation rate that the Federal Reserve watches like a hawk. Speaking of the Fed, it says household wealth in the United States is at an all-time high. Overseas, we're out of money-sucking wars in Afghanistan, and most of the world has a sharply improved opinion of America and faith in the president to do the right thing in world affairs. To recap, jobs, jabs, prosperity, and peace, and yet most Americans are unhappy. Just 28.6% say the country's going in the right direction, says the Real Clear Politics average of all recent polls. And both RCP and 538's aggregate polling shows President Joe Biden's approval hitting new lows, less than 43%. So what gives? My sense is that the administration, from the president on down, isn't doing enough to own the narrative. When nearly 60% of the country say things aren't going well, well, something's up. Perhaps the something is that Democrats have allowed the impressive economic gains occurring on their watch to be overshadowed by their wokeness. Not to denigrate words like equity and fairness, but perhaps Mr. Biden and company should spend more time reminding Americans of the basics. Jobs are plentiful, wages are up, the country is opening up, and things are getting fixed. Biden's an all shucks kind of president. Here's the deal. What we need to see is the president talk up his accomplishments more. Certainly not in the look how great I am Trump way, but certainly not in his own low-key, long-winded way that isn't working now. I keep remembering a line he used as vice president, and I quote, "Osama bin Laden is dead and General Motors is alive. Why hasn't the White House Communication Office or the president himself come up with something pithy that reflects jobs, wages, vaccinations, and peace?" Biden visited Baltimore on Wednesday to talk up the infrastructure bill. Why not hit every swing state, too? Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is a smart, savvy guy. You know what else he is? A verbal spar par excellence. Remember how he went into Fox News last year and destroyed their anchors by turning the tables on them? I'd like to see him do that now to Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity and ask them what's so bad about 6 million jobs, protecting kids, and record wealth for the American people. There's no question that Biden, like any president, has problems. He has stumbled on immigration. It's a tragic fact that the Afghanistan evacuation cost 13 American service members their lives. But it's also true that over 120,000 men, women, and children were evacuated safely and flown to freedom. Inflation is on the rise, blunting the increases in wages. Blame this on the global pandemic, which has gummed up the supply chain. But the way Republicans talk, you'd think it's all because of Biden. Jobs, jabs, prosperity, and peace. That's a good starting point for this president to better own the narrative that he is writing. That article, again, is written by Paul Brandis, who is the founder and White House bureau chief of West Wing Reports and a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors. Dorothy?
Okay, we'll turn our letters to the editor. This first one is from Ivan T. Weber of West Des Moines. The U.S. Senate is unacceptably undemocratic. The problem with Senator Joe Manchin blocking the president's agenda is not Joe Manchin. The problem is the United States Senate and our lack of democracy. It is not that just 17% of the population can control the Senate, the percent of people living in the 26 smallest states, or the 20 million more people voted for Democrats who hold Senate seats than voted for Republicans, nor is the problem the filibuster. The problem is the Senate itself. In the other six nations of the G7, none of their upper houses can block ordinary legislation. The United States Senate is an outdated relic that can no longer be justified in the modern world. Either the Senate or its ability to block legislation needs to go. And that was the opinion of Ivan T. Weber of West Des Moines. This next letter is from State Senator Zach Walls of Coralville. Democrats are actually the ones expanding the broadband access. It's time to give credit where credit is due when it comes to a new initiative to improve access to high-speed broadband across Iowa. While the governor and Republican politicians pretend they are leaders in this effort, the truth is elsewhere. First, passage of a $100 million broadband package by the Iowa legislature earlier this year had the support of Republicans and Democratic legislators. In fact, House File 867 passed the Iowa Senate on a 47-0 vote. There was no partisan wrangling because this is a bipartisan idea that every legislator has been hearing about for years. It was a good day in our state. Second, despite some partisan spin to the contrary, all Iowans deserve quality broadband internet service, October 24th by Senator Zach Nunn and Representative Brian Lowes, Governor Kim Reynolds and all 150 legislators needed passage of the American Rescue Plan to make a real difference for Iowans needing better broadband service. In fact, as the Des Moines Register reported in mid-October, funding from the American Rescue Plan will allow the state of Iowa to triple the amount of state grant money available for broadband projects this year. So let's give credit to the leadership of President Joe Biden and Congresswoman Cindy Axne for passage of the American Rescue Plan over the objections of the rest of Iowa's congressional delegation. Again, that was from State Senator Zach Walls in Coralville. And this last one is from John Klingon of Des Moines. Iowa bridges needed Axne's vote. The condition of the bridges in Iowa are rated the worst in the nation, yet all our members of the House of Representatives, except Cindy Axne, voted against fixing them. Were they not elected to take care of the needs of their constituents and not just to own the libs? After all, if we don't fix the bridges, how else will we be able to travel through rural Iowa and see all the impeach Biden and Trump won signs? Again, from John Klingon of Des Moines.
Okay, we have some time before our obituaries. I'm going to go to the money section and read three short articles on the money line. The first article, Portuguese employers can't text after hours. A new law passed by the Portuguese Parliament makes it illegal for employers to contact employees after work hours, a step the country has made to promote healthier work-life balance amid a surge of home workers during the coronavirus pandemic. And legislation approved on Friday introduced new state laws that mean employers could face financial penalties for contacting employees outside of work hours, including increased gas and electricity bills, according to Portugal's Socialist Party government. The law is part of an effort to appeal to remote workers in coming to Portugal. Our second article is titled Consumer Prices Soar 6.2%, the highest since 1990. A worsening surge of inflation for such bedrock necessities as food, rent, autos, and heating oil is setting Americans up for a financially difficult holiday season. Prices for U.S. consumers jumped 6.2% in October compared with a year earlier, the highest inflation rate since 1990, the Labor Department said on Wednesday. From September to October, prices jumped 0.9%. Inflation is eroding the strong gains in wages and salaries. Consumer demand is fueling the spike in prices. Americans are spending 15% more on goods than before the pandemic. And the third article, electric truck maker Rivian's IPO makes a big splash. Shares in Rivian Automotive are soaring on their first day of trading, rising 37%. It's an auspicious stock market debut for the electric vehicle maker, which has the backing of Ford and Amazon. The opening trade of $106.75 gives Rivian a market value of about $91 billion, greater than that of Ford and General Motors. The company said it will use the proceeds from the IPO to ramp up production. Dorothy?
Okay, on this Veterans Day, let's remember the Tuskegee Airmen honored even as diversity gap lingers. Legendary black unit overcame racial barriers. This by Tom Vanden Broek. The Army's top officer for personnel will salute a legendary black unit on Veterans Day as he pushes for greater diversity in the ranks. Lieutenant General Gary Brito became aware in high school of the Tuskegee Airmen, more than 15,000 black pilots, mechanics, and cooks in the segregated army of World War II. The soldiers flew more than 15,000 sorties and destroyed more than 100 German aircraft after training at Moulton Field in Alabama. Brito learned more about the airmen as one of the three black ROTC students at Penn State University in the mid-1980s. Today, Brito, 57, is one of the Army's top officers and one of the few black soldiers to have held commands of frontline combat units, a near prerequisite to the military's highest ranks. On Thursday, Brito plans to travel to Tuskegee, Alabama, to honor the airmen's service. In an interview, he talked about their legacy and the Army's efforts to diversify what remains a mostly white senior officer corps. The Tuskegee Airmen wanted to serve, have the desire to serve, and serve well, Brito said. In essence, they are very inspirational to me, even after 30 years of service. Despite all of the challenges that they may have had, prejudice or racism or what have you, that they wanted to serve the country is something that you just can't help but look up to. All told, more than 1 million African Americans served in segregated units during World War II. In 1948, President Harry Truman ordered the desegregation of the armed forces, a move that took years to accomplish. The Tuskegee Airmen helped dispel stereotypes. The 99th Pursuit of Squadron composed of black soldiers was a U.S. Army Air Force experiment to demonstrate conclusively that African Americans, if given equal opportunities and training, could fly in, command, and support combat units as well as anyone, according to the National Museum of the United States Air Force. Nearly 75 years since desegregation, the armed services have struggled to diversify its leadership. In the Army, black people make up about 22% of enlisted soldiers, 16.5% of warrant officers, and 11% of officers on active duty. Combat units such as infantry, artillery, armor, and aviation are the primary seedbed for most senior officers. Last year, about 96 combat brigades of about 4,000 soldiers were led by a colonel. Two of them were black. Diversifying leadership of those units has become a priority, Brito said. Leaders from different backgrounds bring different skills to solve problems. It's a matter of fairness, he said. There's no reason for leaders to not represent the soldiers they serve and represent the country of which all soldiers came from, Brito said. We have an all-volunteer army from all of the 50 states and territories. It is important for their leaders, whether it's a sergeant all the way up to general, to be a leader that they can emulate. There's no reason for leaders not to represent the soldiers which they're honored to serve. That's why it's important. A key obstacle to diversifying the officer corps in combat units is the small pool of candidates among people of color. Some reasons are historic. Many in the generation that came of age during Vietnam perceived the Army as exposing black enlisted soldiers to more combat and casualties. That was true earlier in the war, but casualty rates evened out by the end. Convincing young men and women of color to choose combat units when they are young is key, Brito said. It can take 20 years for them to develop into more senior leaders. If you're not going to wave a magic wand and just make a general or a command sergeant major, Brito said, it takes some time, decades, in some cases, to one, attract the talent, bring in the talent, train the talent, and retain it. An increasing number of ROTC and U.S. Military Academy students are choosing combat specialties, he said. Veterans such as Brito's grandfather helped steer him toward the Army. The Tuskegee Airmen and their commitment to teamwork and overcoming obstacles have been an example to him. They made it through obstacles that were in their way. It's very inspirational to me, Brito said. So whether they were a cook or a parachute rigger, whatever they were doing to support this effort, it's very uplifting. Brito is far from the only service member inspired by the Red Tails. In 2020, General Charles Brown, Chief of Staff for the Air Force, interviewed two Tuskegee Airmen to commemorate the anniversary of the end of World War II. I want to thank you for paving the way, not only for me, but for so many others that have the opportunity to serve, Brown said, the first black officer to lead the Air Force. One of the last surviving airmen, Lieutenant Colonel Enoch Woodhouse, visited the Red Tail Flight Academy in September to congratulate seven students from the underserved community starting there. The Academy said its goal is to increase the percentage of minority aviators from less than 2.5% in military and commercial space to at least 4% in the next 10 years. The airmen recognize the importance of our role and what it means to people coming along after us, particularly the African-American men. Tuskegee Airman Val Archer said while visiting the Tuskegee Airmen Aviation Career Training Program at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport in 2013. Your potential is incredible. It's more than my generation ever dreamed of, he said. Archer died in 2020.
Home market remains hot as sellers reap faster rewards. This is another article out of the money section of the USA Today. Fall has historically been a slow period for the U.S. housing market, but the pandemic housing market still seems to be going strong. In each month from March through October, the typical U.S. home spent fewer days on the market than in the fastest selling month from 2016 to 2020, according to a new Realtor.com report. In October, an average home spent 45 days on the market, slightly longer than the previous month's average of 43 days. But homes still sold faster than in any other October in recent history, including 2020, when it was 8 days less, and 2019, when it was 21 days more. Homes are also more expensive. The median listing price last month reached $380,000, 9% higher than in October 2020 and 22% higher than October of 2019. The pandemic market has been defined by a smaller pool of homes for sale. At 636,606 active listings in October, inventory fell 22% from the previous October and 52% from October of 2019. There were 5,975 more homes under contract than actively listed homes, taking a step back from improvements in inventory seen since June. The fact that we still have relatively low inventory levels heading into this last part of the year suggests that the market is still very competitive and likely to remain so, says Daniel Hale, the chief economist for Realtor.com. Buyers are facing some real challenges in the market, she said, pointing out higher prices, fast-moving sales, and mortgage rates that have crept higher. The 50 largest U.S. markets saw a slight increase in annual listing price growth in October, rising by an average of 5% versus last month's rate of 4%. At least five metros saw an annual listing price increase of 18%. That includes Austin, Texas, that went up 35.2%, Las Vegas, Nevada, went up 27.2%, Tampa, Florida, up 21.8%, Orlando, Florida, up 20%, and Denver, up 18.3%. Dorothy? Okay, we'll go to a couple of birthdays here quick. If I can find the birthdays, and maybe I won't. Let's see here. We have... Well, I don't seem to be able to. Here we go. A couple of birthdays for today. Country singer Narvel Feltz is 83 years of age. Guitarist Vince Martell of Vanilla Fudge is 76. Keyboardist Jim Paterick of the Ides of March and formerly of Survivor, 71 years of age today. Singer-keyboardist Paul Cowsill of the Cowsills is 70 today. Singer Marshall Crenshaw, 68. Singer-guitarist Andy Partridge of XTC is 68. Singer Dave Alvin is 66. Synthesizer player Ian Craig Marsh of Human League Heaven, 17, is 65. Actor Stanley Tucci, 61. Actor Demi Moore, 58. Actor Calista Flockhart of Ally McBeal is 57. Actor Frank John Hughes is 54. TV personality Carson Kressley of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy is 52. Actor David Deluze of Wizards of Waverly Place is 50. Actor Tyler Christopher of General Hospital, 49. Actor Leonardo DiCaprio, one we know, 47 years of age. Actor Scoot McNairy of Argo is 44. Late Show with Stephen Colbert, musical director John Batiste is 35. And finally, actress Krista B. Allen of Revenge is 30 years of age today.